David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks, and welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 350.
Oh, boy, hold on to your seats. This is going to be a good one.
I'm your host, Steve Raker, worshipping the complex and not always receptive moon god Khonshu from my hidden altar down here in the comic book bunker. Marvel Noise is the podcast proudly sponsored by nobody for 350 episodes, although the host of this show remains indebted to the good folks who run the Baltimore Comic-Con, which we all hope will be able to be held October 23rd, 24th, and 25th at the Baltimore Convention Center in the Inner Harbor zone of Baltimore. The guest list there is always fantastic, and information can be found at baltimorecomiccon.com. I hope to see you in Baltimore. New episodes of Marvel Noise are announced, and feedback is welcome on Marvel Noise's Twitter feed or Facebook page, and episodes both new and old can be streamed or downloaded at marvelnoise.com. There's a handy little drop-down calendar menu on the right-hand side. This episode, as we've done with half-century and century landmark episodes in the past, we will be covering every Marvel issue 350. The list is now down to 8, true believer. But first, I want to wrap up my coverage of the initial pre-Empire Strikes Back era of modern Marvel Star Wars comics with a look at the last few arcs of the very entertaining Dr. Aphra series. I really think Dr. Aphra has been the jewel of this now not-so-new era of Marvel Star Wars stories. The storytelling on Dr. Aphra has been consistently good. The scenarios are dramatic. The characterization is terrific. This has been a great original Star Wars series. And the last three arcs of her book, written by Simon Spurrier, didn't disappoint. Dr. Aphra 26-31... The Worst Among Equals, is drawn by Emilio Liazzo. Here, Dr. Aphra is forced to stay in the close proximity of the evil, sadistic murder droid 000, you know, the dark C-3PO, because of implanted proximity-triggered bombs. They go back and forth in a quite twisted but entertaining game of trust, betrayal, and survival. Injured with her legs temporarily paralyzed, Aphra is able to restore 000's missing memory, and he learns that he was a psychotic AI reject. Aphra is also able to restore 000's R2-like companion, the torture droid BT-1. She originally met these droids, and first appeared herself, in the first Darth Vader series, when Darth Vader was going behind the Emperor's back and working on a solo project and needed to have some resources that were in play working for him on the side. It was a good series. Aphra finally shakes the attention of these evil droids when she takes a bullet for Trip, that's her name for 000, and gets left for dead. The next arc flows through issues 32 through 36, Unspeakable Rebel Superweapon, drawn by Wilton Santos, Andrea Brocardo, and Chris Bolson. The rebels here kidnap Dr. Aphra for a Jedi artifact that she stole that can be weaponized. The leader of the rebel squad is Aphra's ex, so it allows them some flashbacks to their past and, you know, to address their love-hate relationship and everything. Plus, the evil Wookiee Black Chrysantan returns. But is he friend or foe? And Aphra betrays the rebels and gets caught up in a plot to kill the Emperor. But whose side is she going to end up falling on? Dr. Aphra 37-40, A Rogue's End, finishes up the series. This arc, still written by Spurrier, is drawn by Casper Wingard. This arc has Aphra forced to work for the Empire again, and in close proximity to Darth Vader, which really freaks her out because, you know, they've got history. Aphra is stationed with a team of other archaeologists, providing insight into possible remote temples and ruins that the rebels might look for, like to hide in or make their next headquarters from. These archaeologists skirt the line between giving the Empire what they want and using the Empire's resources in their own legitimate archaeological pursuits. Aphra, on the other hand, she's just about self-preservation, and being this close to Vader is like walking on eggshells. Aphra's dad turns up, and heck, she has enough trouble keeping herself alive without having to worry about someone else, and her dad doesn't make it easy either. Aphra's ex, the rebel commander, returns and plays a chase game of cat and mouse that results in Aphra learning of the base at Hoth. Will she betray the rebels to Vader? Will she survive whatever course of action she does choose to take? And of course, Triple Zero and BT return too. This last ish is a fantastic finale to both the arc and the series. This was a really good read. Empire Ascendant is a one-shot that serves as both an epilogue to the first wave of new Star Wars tales from the last 5 years that covered the time between Star Wars A New Hope and The Empire Strikes Back, and the four new series that will launch in the post-Empire era that is to come. There's a Star Wars tale, a Vader tale, a Baylert Valance story. He's going to be the lead in a new Bounty Hunter series. And the only story in this one-shot that had any real sense of mattering, a Dr. Aphra tale, which is a true epilogue to her series, showing her friends and family's reactions to her actions in issue 40. As a whole, though, this issue can be skipped. And with that comes a close of our coverage of the pre-Empire era that comprised of 75 issues of Star Wars, 2 25-issue Darth Vader series, 40 issues of Dr. Aphra, and numerous limited series, specials, annuals, crossovers, and movie adaptations. May the Force be with Marvel as they move forward into the next phase, the period between Empire and Return of the Jedi. Here we go, true believers, as we did for the milestone episode 100, 150, 200, 250, and 300. We've gathered around the virtual but still plenty prestigious table today to cover every Marvel issue 350. Along with me, your host, Steve Raker, we've got Andrew the LA Rabbit.
Hey, guys.
WWX Kevin from the Great White North.
Icebox.
Friend of the show, good old Gary Arkell is back. Thanks for doing this with us, Gary.
How you doing?
And not a hoax, not an imaginary tale, back on Marvel Noise, where he belongs, is one of our favorite alumni, Alan, our very own New Mutant, Mr. Power Principal himself. Google it.
Himself. Yeah, Google it.
Google it, we'll wait.
Only... but Power Principal with a principal instead of a pal.
Where's the best place to find the principal these days?
At thepowerprincipal.co.
There you go.
I do believe. Yeah. If I'm not wrong.
That makes it easy. So
yeah.
We have 8 issue 350s for you. And the first one, you know, you've heard this song and dance before, thanks to the numberings of the old series from before the Marvel age of comics, like Journey into Mystery and Tales to Astonish and Tales to Suspense and stuff. Some of our characters launched into that 350 much earlier than the others, who had to work from issue number one. So in the end of 1984, the first Marvel issue 350 is Thor, which was previously Journey into Mystery. And this was written and drawn by Walt Simonson. It's Ragnarok and Roll.
Fancy name. I like that. I got a chuckle out of it.
I ended up reading this off the Marvel Unlimited, but I only have the first Walt Simonson artist edition. But if you have the second one, you could actually read this issue out of the artist edition for that beautiful full size. Yeah, I got the first one. I've cooled on buying those things. But for me, this was prime. Walt Simonson was my Thor. It was a long-running title. He jumped on 337, reintroduces Beta Ray Bill, who in the beginning I didn't really like. He was kind of a bad guy and beat up Thor. But you come around to him quickly. And it's not to knock on like Trimpy and the team before, but it was really a sea change, I felt. Like, Thor had been on Earth with Sif, and they kind of split up. And so it just jumps right back into... And there's some pretty fundamental changes, the shift out of Don Blake and things that happen at this run. Plus that long running, he has the Ragnarok storyline that starts with his first issue with him crafting the sword and everything. And that ran such a long time. And it was so exciting to like every issue would be like two pages. Like,
yeah, this is more than a year into his run. And it was surprisingly a regular sized, regular priced issue, which surprised me because it was building up to this big Surtur war, and this was the first phase of that Asgardian Surtur war on Earth. Like, I'm surprised they didn't pad it with like a reprint, a Hembeck strip, you know, a backup, a pinup, and then charge an extra buck or something for it, you know?
Yeah. Well, for movie fans, Thor 2, The Cask of Winters and all that is done probably more entertainingly here in the issues leading up to this than and that one. But yeah, it was just, I liked Simonson. I liked this. It felt like a real change from the previous status quo and this kind of epic storytelling.
So
and epic. Baldur was going through all this crazy business. He had just gotten back, but it didn't feel like it felt still placed. Like, he didn't undo the last guy's stuff, or it didn't feel like he was throwing shade on the last guy. I don't always like that when the new guy has to come in and be like, oh, ignore all that, was just a doom bot or whatever. Like,
yeah, we'll get to that. But,
yeah, no kidding.
But you know, the classic and sorry to talk about this whole run in more of a big picture, but I remember when they get to 362 and the Executioner as the last stand and all that. And, yeah, this was all the comics I really ate up, because in 84, I'm entering teen years and kind of still a little silly, I guess you'd say, and way over dramatic. And so the big, like, you may say this is a little overwrought, but it was perfect if you're that age and into overwrought superhero comics.
Wow, it's the whole Simonson run in one issue.
I would feel like the Simonson himself knew how to capture, and for Nordic gods, overblown and dramatic is the issue of the day. And like, that's what you do with gods.
And this issue was all out melee. It's Thor, Beta Ray Bill, and Sif return, the Warriors 3, the Avengers, they're all on Earth fighting the fiery hordes of Muspelheim, and they're burning down the city, and I'm thinking, as I'm rereading this, forgetting the sequence of events, that, you know, why doesn't Thor just put out the fire with his hammer, right? He can bring the rains. And sure enough, he does it. But it was was a trick. Surtur set him up so that he could create a beautiful rainbow after the rains, that Surtur could march his way up to Asgard. And so it sets up a big confrontation between Odin and Surtur that happens the next issue.
Does that mean that in the canon of the 616 Marvel Universe, every rainbow that comes after a rainstorm is the Rainbow Bridge to Asgard?
Maybe the ones that Thor makes.
Mjolnir
does have that warping ability, you know?
I love Bill's hammer design, too. Yeah. Like, I went back and was reading. I started from when Simonson took over so I could read some fun. But so I read a lot more of this.
We could tell.
But yeah, it was just fun because he came on as like a bad guy. And then one our collective hearts, but the hammer, because it has the other side with the blade on it, the flat end and the blade side. I just thought it was a pretty great design and a classic evoking the kind of more of us that played D&D and stuff. Like, that's the sort of hammer I pictured when I played those types of role-playing fantasy settings.
And it's golden instead of, I guess that's a big stone head of Thor's hammer.
Right.
Uru. He got the gold-plated Uru or Uru or Unru or
Yuhu or... His name is it's Stormbringer. Am I not right?
That's a good...
Yeah. I never understood why an alien would be named Bill.
That's a great point.
I kept on waiting for the story of explaining his real alien name and not the Earthling name of Bill.
Well, I think Stormbringer has a good Asgardian sound to it because, you know, like Thor's like battle warrior sheep are... Teeth Grinder and Tooth Gnasher, you know, Stormbringer. It kind of has that same. Right. It's in that same family of nomenclature. Well,
I believe, not being an expert on the languages, but I believe the goat names are actually lifted from what little remains of the Norse translated, the Eddas, because those were all transcribed, would have been hundreds of years after the peak of it. So there's always a question of how faithful those things are, not including the translation issues. But yeah, because as a kid I enjoyed reading all the little mythology books, because you kind of get away with reading that because it wasn't technically a comic book. So
don't tell me Tooth Grinder ain't real.
I think he's telling you exactly that it is exactly real. Like, it predates Tooth Gnasher and Tooth Gnasher,
something
somebody
like that.
Gnasher.
Something.
Yeah.
they predate the comic books.
Yeah.
And for me, this is my first big exposure to Walt Simonson. I know all the Manhunter fans are going to be mad at me, but I was not reading that stuff whenever it came out. So this, for me, was my big launch into when I think of Walt Simonson, this is what I think of. I may have read something he worked on before that, but this is really, for me, what I come to associate him with. Like I said, no knock on Manhunter or the other stuff. I just... At the time, I didn't grab those issues. Wasn't that in a split book or something over at the Distinguished Competition?
It was a backup.
It was a backup, right.
Yeah.
4 years later, in 1988, The Incredible Hulk 350 hits the shelves. Oof. With Peter David writing and Jeff Purves penciling and Terry Austin inking. It's Before the Fall, The Hulk versus The Thing, and Dr. Doom.
Saving Grace.
That thing is probably the most rough thing I've ever seen drawn. It takes a lot getting used to.
Terry Austin saved this book, I think.
Yeah. Yep.
His inks.
Dr. Doom tricks the Joe Fixit Gray Hulk into fighting the Thing, but this is the pineapple spiked-headed Ben Grimm of the late 80s. Mm-hmm. And he's say what you will, but he's really, really strong. So that was interesting to see the rematch when Ben Grimm is actually the stronger one of the two. The Hulk is more depowered here in his gray form. And just as the Thing is standing over a defeated Joe Fixit, he has to fight a more familiar Green Hulk Smash type Hulk. And it's like, how can there be two Hulks? And it's so funny, Doom has repurposed that old Eternals robot Hulk from the 70s. Like, I love when that robot Hulk shows up. It keeps showing up like every once in a while.
I remember this issue. I don't remember a lot, but as I started reading, I'm like, oh yeah. And old time Marvel Noise listeners, if they want to dial back to episode 227, Kevin and I discussed Thunderbolts 16 and 17, or the Thunderbolts face robot Hulk.
Yep.
Yes.
I like to plug old episodes.
I read that Eternals, and I read it I read that Eternals out of just sequence, no, in sequence, because I wanted to catch up on Eternals and I wanted to read Jack Kirby's stuff. And when that robot Hulk showed up, I didn't know what was going on.
Yeah,
I didn't
totally
know what was going on.
Yeah,
I was like, what is this?
That's my situation.
Where did this, where did this thing come from? So I had the impression that it was like maybe plotted by someone outside of Kirby's camp and slotted in there somehow, and then Kirby just kind of moved some pieces around and said, okay, I'll just have this guy have invented the Hulk. I'll just plop him here and I'll just get rid of this sequence and it just seemed to have nothing to do with Kirby's design for the Eternals whatsoever.
And like, had they decided really whether they wanted the Eternals to be an in-continuity book yet or not? Because it hadn't really crossed, you know, it hadn't bumped uglies with any of the other Marvel books, really. And then Hulk shows up, and it's like, okay, there's a, but it's not. It's Robot Hulk. So it's like, oh.
Yeah, I think at that point in time, they forced Jack to put Eternals in the Marvel Universe.
Jack, make him a robot.
I can believe
it. Well, also, this wasn't 16 or so the last. It didn't last much longer than,
no.
than that anyway. So that was... they either do it at the beginning or at the end where they're like, quick, put a more popular character on.
So in the rest of this issue, Doom wipes the dust off of Joe Fixit and gives him like a pep talk and sends him back out into the ring. And this time he defeats the Thing because he's now a thinking Hulk, right? So he uses his guile and cunning tactics.
I thought this was clever, like tiring him out. I was not a big, like the Joe Fixit Hulk was not particularly interesting to me, but I'm always down for a Thing Hulk punch up. And this one doesn't really seem fair because the Thing fought like the Hulk twice and a Robot Hulk once. But I thought it was good for him running him around and all that stuff. And I actually busted out the CD-ROMs of this one so I could see if there was no letter pages or anything interesting. Oh. But there was an ad for Inferno in the middle of this thing, and I'm like, whoa, it's fun to remember all the event. But for me the jarring thing was the Beast makes a quick appearance. And it's not a model I'm super familiar with. Like, I remember Pineapple Headed Thing. I always liked that they put Ben Grimm through changes. He was kind of like Iron Man, you know, like every few years to goose it up, they'd run through and change his look to make it interesting.
Armor, as it were. I hated this Hulk. I mean, this Thing.
Me too.
I never liked this design for the Thing. And it's just funny that we're doing the 350s because later on you'll find out how he even became this pineapple-headed Hulk. I mean, Thing. But and I had to remind myself while reading this that I was reading a Hulk book.
right.
I hated that Ben got defeated on his second battle that night. It's so unfair, and I thought that, you know, you wore the poor guy down, and then you tried to drown him. It was just wrong to me.
Yep.
But then, okay, it's the Hulk's book. Of course they're going to let the Hulk win.
It seems like such a crazy design. Like, didn't the artist realize, like, he's going to have to replicate all that nonsense? Like, I know I'm the worst person.
So like Joe Sinnott was like, I'm leaving the book after 40 years doing it straight.
I mean, I know I'm lazy. I would pick like the easiest design, but this looks like just an insane amount of as much time as you want to spend fiddling with those play. I don't know. Like I said, I appreciate their dedication, but whenever I see something I'm like that, I'm like, whoa. What about shortcuts? Like we'll just color three rings of Captain America's chainmail and you guess the rest is in there.
Speaking of Captain America, 2 months later in early 1989, Captain America, previously Tales of Suspense, written by Mark Gruenwald, drawn by Kieron Dwyer, inks by Al Milgrom. It's issue 350 of Cap.
Oh, this one's so good. This is a Marvel comic. This is peak Captain America. This is peak everything.
It's the culmination of a time where Steve Rogers was stripped of his shield and it was given to the not always so even-keeled super patriot whose name was John Walker. And Rogers donned a black uniform, calling himself the Captain, and like eventually they'd swap and the Super Patriot would wear the Captain's uniform and call himself U.S. Agent, and then Cap would be Cap again. But this ish has the return of the Red Skull, who we had last seen, we thought he died as an old man in Cap 300. And now he inhabits a cloned body of Captain America, and he's chosen to... He's going to, like, live his own American dream by playing the game and manipulating the already highly manipulatable American bureaucracies and kind of bend them to his will and take over things from the inside.
Oh, that, I love that motivation. That whole panel where he's looking at the government through his window, all sort of like Wilson Fisk-like.
Oh, the Commission on Superhuman Activities, and yeah, just the Red Skull is back. I remember it just starts with him. This is another one I actually remember reading, because it starts with him going through guys dressed like Captain America, because Walker had been so unstable. I think you undersold it, Steve. Like, he was crazy. And it was just weird to see this guy dressed like Cap going on and doing all kinds of bad things to the Cap name. And the shield was a big point of contention between the two of them. Like, who's going to get the shield? But this also is one of those ones where I never like that, like, the guy comes off his hospital bed and fights, like, 40 dudes or something. I'm always like, ugh, really?
They're superheroes. You can do stuff like this.
Giving me a break. But I did like the ad. I busted out the disc for all these, and this one had this awesome, the Studio 4 home DJ machine. Like, it had your own home DJ machine. You can become a wrestle disc jockey at home. So it's got like faders, like the tape deck and a little plastic microphone. And I'm like, I do not remember that toy at all, but I guess that's how we launched a whole, you know, there's so many people that are DJs now. I wonder how many of them got their start. But the cigarette.
The skull reveals himself to Rogers after having been in hiding and everything, and he sets up the two Captain Americas to face off against each other. And Walker, he's brutal. He's, like, intent on killing Rogers. But Rogers ends up putting him down. And the skull is all gloating to Rogers, and I can't help but think of Andrew anytime the skull tries pulls out the cigarette holder, you know, the long-stemmed cigarette holder. He's setting Captain America up to blast him in the face with the skull powder, but Super Patriot from the ground, Walker, throws the shield and hits the skull, and he comes off balance, and he takes it in the face. And
my face! I can't get pudding in it!
And instead of having another evil Steve Rogers out there, now we have a Red Skull with the body of a Captain America out there. The skull is reborn.
I love how all Captain American villains, if they have some sort of deformity, it just keeps happening. If you're Zemo, you're always going to get your face messed up. If you're the skull, you're like, these guys can't avoid, like... You'd think something else, like, oh, maybe I could burn my hand. Nope, it's always got to be whatever adhesive X or the dust of death. Like, it's the no matter how many clone bodies you get, you always end up getting a face full of that stuff in the end. But I'm also glad they got the dedication correct about Joe Simon and Jack Kirby.
Sure.
Too many times that stupid Stan Lee and Jack Kirby dedication on these things, and you're like, argh.
Not in the comics, usually. The comics usually get it right. In the end, Steve Rogers surprisingly refuses to take the shield back, but Walker convinces him that he really should, and so he does. Then, you know, this is what a milestone issue should be like, right? A little kind of square bound, and you can flip to the back, and there's some double page spread pinups of Cap's girlfriends and Cap's sidekicks and the six Captain Americas of the time, you know, and then there's a 10-page backup by John Byrne that shows Arnim Zola and the whole process of reinserting the skull's dead consciousness back into a cloned body of Steve Rogers. They show how it all went down.
Plus, it's a nice, looks old-fashioned.
It's a nice summary of a lot of the skull, too. I mean, not that we wouldn't have, but if you were a new reader, Like, it'd be cool to be like, oh, wow, here's this whole, who is the Red Skull? Why is he such a bad dude? And you get this whole nice little backup piece that looks good. But, yeah, I enjoyed this whole time of Captain America. Like, the Flag Smasher was a villain I really enjoyed. Yeah, all this time. And we're about to head into the Crossbones and all that stuff is coming up for those that hang around.
Now, was this before or after the situation where Magneto imprisoned Red Skull in a bunker because he was mad at him for the Holocaust?
I think this is before.
I think this is before those cross the big event, the
Acts of Vengeance. Yeah.
I was going to say the superhero square dance where they change partners, but
and then you get stuck in a hole. Greatest in a hole scene.
And also, I don't remember this one. This copy they scanned in has the G.I. Joe where you can have your own personalized G.I. Joe action figure with your own car. Wow. Like, I don't remember that at all. And I read this issue.
Does that mean they make one to look like you?
No, it looks like a generic guy, but what you do is you answer a bunch of questions. So when the file card comes back, it says, Alan White is a leader who is good at machine guns and taekwondo, you know, and you check whatever boxes you want, what branch of the service. And I assume you give yourself a code name. Oh, yeah, you make up your own code name. So you'd be New Mutant.
That would go over big.
Yeah, we have Super Steve and Whirlwind X and Gregarious Gary or whatever nickname we're given.
G.I. Gary.
You're now in charge of making all the code names for everybody.
Oh, those are all existing code names. Kevin made it easy with his Whirlwind and Super Steve just rolls off the tongue. But yeah, I do
it
remember.
Does.
For me, the old Captain America's was the best part because I vaguely remembered like Jeff Mace a little bit. Mm. And the one that had the old timey
Spirit of 76 hat. Yeah.
Yeah, that one. Those guys always freaked me out for some reason. I always felt like they were weird. Captain, like weird.
That was
fake
all,
Captain,
you know.
Marcus.
Roy Thomas had to explain where all those caps came from in between World War II Cap and Avengers 4. You know, that's all Roy Thomas stuff.
He's Cap.
So a couple of years later, in 1991, the Fantastic Four hits issue 350, all on its own, right from issue number one. Alan, surprisingly, this one too, weird. Written and drawn by Walter Simonson.
Yeah.
And we've got Dr. Doom, more Doom. He really loves to mess with the Thing, and he does so again here. The issue opens up with Doom retaking Latveria from Christoph. Remember Christoph? He's the young protege, failsafe heir. He's been like ruling Latveria way back since Burns' run. And Doom...
Why does Doom 29-9 show up in this?
Doom and Christoph, they get interrupted by this third silver-plated Doom in an armor we've never seen, claiming he's the real Doom and he's been away for a very long time, don't you know? He's only been back a few times, which then retcons any number of Doom stories that you want. He utters a code word and Christoph's psyche is restored. This is Doom. And he learns that the Thing is now human, as Ben Grimm, and that his love interest, Sharon, is a female Thing. And then he's like, wait, and Alicia married Johnny, and the Thing didn't kill Johnny? How is this possible?
we were all asking ourselves that question. Seriously.
I do think it's smart, again, where they're able, this lets people who wanted to grab a big issue and get caught up. Like, I think it's smart when you can give a story reason and find a way to wrap these things around. I just always appreciate when they're like, oh yeah, we're gonna try. It can be a little awkward, but I really thought it was a clever way of like getting people up. And I can't be you guys all did what I did, right? And wound back a few issues to get the classic alternate Fantastic Four with Spider-Man and Wolverine.
Oh, Wolverine.
Like, yeah, like
Ghost Rider.
That was just a few issues before this, so I. And when I saw where this was placed, I immediately wound back the clock a little. I'm like, oh, I got to read this. That's the most famous Fantastic Four story outside of Galactus.
Arthur Adams art.
Yeah. Very classic.
So on Doom's end, he's all trying to reacclimate himself to what's going on and see how he's going to manipulate things. On the Fantastic Four side, the Sharon Ventura thing is like scolding Ben for breaking out the old mechanical thing suit. I love when the old mechanical thing suit, I like that as much as when the old mechanical Hulk appears. And so she storms out and she gets propositioned by Doom that he's going to do what Reed can't do, you know, and change her back to human form. Meanwhile, Ben is undergoing a process back at the Baxter building to change back from human back into a thing form so he can be with her because the suit doesn't cut it. And so, you know, they're both, you know, they're screwed.
It's the gift of the Magi.
Yep.
Right? It's the one totally. For love tries to make the sacrifice for the other one while the other one is doing something that will invalidate the sacrifice. And they wind up on opposite ends again of their love spectrum.
No, this just wraps right around to my theory about Ben Grimm, the character. And that is, he really wants to be the thing. He has to complain because he doesn't like being ugly, but I can't blame him. He can't give up the power. So it's always, whenever he gets turns human, he's always going to find a way, even though he can't admit it to himself, that what he really, how he finds fulfillment is to be the thing. Like, he's not going to go back and be a regular human anymore. Like, who, you've stood on the negative zone. You've faced off against, like, really, you're just going to go back and get a job, like the Incredibles, like as an insurance? No. He's addicted to the power, and as well he should be. And I like that it's unspoken, too, but that's what drives that guy. He can't give it up. So that's why he's not wearing the suit to make her feel comfortable. He's wearing the suit because he doesn't want to be a puny human. And
after
being at the mountaintop, who wants to be? Yeah, but you have also never had, like, the superhuman powers.
It's true.
He's the self-proclaimed idol of millions, you know? Bashful Benji. So the Fantastic Four, they go to Latveria, and they have to deal with traps. Don't you love Doom traps, like where they're separated and they each have a trap that's like for them?
But why don't they ever get hip to that, though? Like, as soon as they step foot on Latverian soil, they should know, stay together. We need to stay together because if we get separated, he's going to suck us into these traps specifically designed for us and depower us every single time.
But they always break out of them. Because, you know, like, they're not that great a trap. Like, they're okay for delaying them, but they always find their way out of the trap. Like, it's the age-old dance, but I think it's done well here because, first of all, I dig the art on this and the action. And this is what we want. We want Doom back. We want him to be an arrogant jerk. We want him to try and show up Reed. We want him to yell at the thing. I mean, he really, this whole thing is predicated on the insult that thing gave him back in what issue, like 12 or something, like when he beat him up. And it's like, it's pretty awesome. They're pulling back on that thread to be like, this is the Doom you want. Like, okay, maybe you don't like him in the Doom 2099 armor. Okay, I get that. But you want that attitude. You want that sass. Like, that's not, and he's so arrogant. Of course, it's crappy. Traps aren't really going to work. But the whole point is it leads into this. His whole thing is he just wants to fight Reed in a little battle. And that's how it is. A lot of these ones are interesting because they kind of, like, the Cap was a fine, like an ending point, but the Thor and this one are both actually kind of leading you to the next issue more directly. Like, there isn't the resolution in the same way that you got out of the Cap one and the Hulk one.
Yep.
I think the 351 for Fantastic Four is a legendary issue, too.
Absolutely. The time jumping. Yeah.
Yeah. But after seeing them roll into Latveria, having all the traps and something, I need like a Castlevania game where they're going through the whole village and everything, slowly leading their way to the castle and everything. And instead of Dracula, it would be Doom. It would be great.
Doombots? Just like Doombots would be the mid-boss?
Yeah.
Now, what I want to know is if this falls chronologically after the Hulk, then why was he the pineapple-headed thing
you know
in
what?
That comic?
Alan, like you, I don't like the pineapple Hull thing, and I didn't like the era of that Steve Englehart era on the book. It's really the one era of the Fantastic Four book that I really, well, I guess maybe not the only one, because we lived through the Fraction one that ended up breaking up our Fantastic Foresight segment, right? but the Englehart era that happened when I was out of comics and when I came back in like 89 or 90 and kind of went back to see what I missed and what happened after Byrne, that was the time when he became Pineapple thing for most of the time. This is a revisitation of that. He hulks out, he's fighting with Doom, and he gets so mad. We just get so mad, Alan, that he like he gets spikes. Spikes just start shooting out, and he turns back into Pineapple thing. But this
back
is
into,
yes, yes. Okay. And fortunately, it's just short lived. Just while he was really mad there. And okay. It was just, you know, because Simonson got him back to being human, and then he brought him back, and he's like the thing we all remember, thank God, and then he had to just tease us with the Pineapple thing one more time.
I see.
Yeah, yeah. So it's going to be okay.
Whenever, though.
It's going to be good. It's going to be okay.
Well, I'm reading it now, so I
concur. Later that year, The Amazing Spider-Man hit issue 350, written by David Michelinie, with art by Eric Larson and Randy Emberlin. Even more Doctor Doom, guys. Are you noticing a theme here? There's a lot of Doctor Doom in issue 350s.
And this is my sweet spot. And Doom.
The Black Fox, the aged but cunning super thief, steals a jewel that belonged to Doom's mother, and Doom is after him. And confronts the fox on a rooftop, but Spidey intervenes and fights. Well, it's more like he gets creamed by Doom for like 11 pages. And then Spidey makes a deal with Doom. Give me 24 hours to recover the jewel and save the fox. And so that's what the rest of the issue goes off from there. But this Larson art is great. And it reminded me that I really, as a reader at the time, and you can correct me if you think I need to be corrected, but I like this era of the art better than the McFarlane stuff. I really love this Larson art on Spidey.
An opinion is an opinion. Who can correct you on what you think?
I'm not going to correct you.
I can. Sure, Steve. Steve Ditko was the best Spider-Man artist.
Yeah,
so.
But I was just about to say, Ditko seems to be so evoked,
yes,
in this artwork.
Yes.
What the only thing I have, he really likes the extremes as far as, like, Spider-Man's foot is always, like, next to his ear, twisted in some crazy way, and Dr. Doom's proportions, like, sometimes he has, like, a tiny head on, like, a huge butt, which isn't necessarily bad, but it's very intense to just pick up out of nowhere and read an issue of this where you haven't had the transition of this era of the, we're starting the 90s, of this sort of how we're going to go forward with it. And I did like the fox or what, but I just felt this character got kind of beat into the ground a little. Like, it's a one trick pony of, he always kind of gets away. Like, he never goes to prison, but he always gets thwarted. And it felt like they reached into that bag many, yeah, many times. Although I do wish if I could go back in time, I would get one of these kick-ass Marvel sleeping bags, although they call them slump bags that they advertise. And I love the extra features. Although for some reason, and I don't understand, okay, if you have the issue, there's a bullpen bulletins full-page cartoon strip by Stan Lee and John Romita. And because it's a bullpen bulletins, they didn't put it on the Unlimited. Yeah. But it's a strip. It's not a art column. I don't know. The Unlimited sometimes frosts me. What I love is he got all these great extra contributors to,
yeah,
like Joe Sinnott.
Well, there's five pinups by Eric Larson, each with a different inker. So John Romita Sr. inks one. Joe Sinnott, as you said. Al Williamson does the Daredevil one. Sal Buscema does the inks on a solo Captain Universe and Cardiac pinup. And then, yeah, there's a split image which I just saw posted on Facebook in one of the art books I'm in today, where someone had the original of this pinup on his wall. It's a half McFarlane, half Larson Spidey, and it's the, you know, the red and blue and the black costume Spidey. Really cool piece. Well,
that's a pretty valuable piece to have. Wow. Yeah, whenever I see Cardiac, I think of Kevin, because that's like his number one Spider-Man villain.
You know, he showed up recently, and I was very happy.
What issue was that that he showed up in, or just what era, or on under whose pen? You remember?
It was either Jason Aaron or Al Ewing.
Because because you're kind of pricking my memory too, because I'm thinking I have been thinking that the Black Fox has been brought forward
in the Black Cat.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so I figure so Cardiac is in the mix somewhere, but I can't remember which title, who was writing it, who drew him, stuff like that. I can't remember.
In Valkyrie, he's been showing up.
But I like what they're doing with Black Fox in the Black Cat thing, and it seems like he's fulfilling more of the kind of function that redeems him, instead of what you see in this and kind of the problems you're having with him in this issue. They found something that makes sense for him to be, like a elder statesman of thieves to guide the younger thieves.
I think there's potential there.
Old guy getting trashed all the time.
Yeah. I just felt they fell into this pattern of, like, he tricks Spider-Man and gets away, but he gets foiled. And I just felt like there were a bunch of those stories, and they weren't in a row, but that's just my memory of it, is like, man, is this going to be the same bit?
Yeah, that's, you know, the steal.
You can't do the same gimmick.
You don't want to send an old man to jail. Right.
Yeah, I just felt like, yeah, I kind of do at this point, you know.
What?
Go with you going to prison, like
justice, God dang it.
You know, because it always did the Vulture good, and that was an old dude, and
he sent the Vulture to jail. Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
It was never clear how old the Vulture was. He was just an old looking dude. Like, it's hard. He's one of those guys that it's like, what? He's in his 40s?
That's awesome.
You know, when you're running the funeral parlor and everything.
Well, he looks older than the other Vultures, that's for sure.
The next year, the summer of 1992, The Avengers reach issue 350, written by Bob Harris with art by Steve Epting and Tom Palmer. This is a flipbook that had a reprint of Avengers 53, where they fight the X-Men in the back of it, too.
Try to see the difference between Black Knight and Corsair. I'm not sure if you can tell them apart if they don't have their costumes on.
The Kree put out a bounty on the Black Knight's head for killing the Supreme Intelligence at the end of Operation Galactic Storm. And they sort of blackmail Raza of the Starjammers with Hepzibah, the Cat Lady, as a witness to take on the mission to kill the Black Knight, because they have info that would reunite him with his long-lost family, Raza, that is. And at this time, the Avengers are the Black Knight and Thor and Hercules and the Black Widow, Circe, the Vision, and Crystal, and Quicksilver's hanging out because Crystal's there. So Raza and Hepzibah trick the rest of the Starjammers, Corsair included, to head to Earth, where they visit and schmooze and hang out with the Avengers, and Professor X and Cyclops shows up too and stuff. Meanwhile, Raza sneaks off to kill the Black Knight, who's working, like, doing some machinery work on one of their vehicles and stuff, and they fight for like 9 pages where the Black Knight does not want to fight back. But when Raza misses him and trashes his jalopy, he's like, oh, it's on.
It's on now. We done did it now.
If you want a little backstory, head to Marvel Noise episode 328 from April of last year, April 3rd, and we talk about Operation Galactic Storm. If you want to get in the headspace, you can understand what Dane's problem is here. I really enjoyed Epting and Palmer work, but I feel like there's some pretty thin soup in the plot mechanics. Like, it was a fun dance, but some of the turns and twists take a pretty good dose of looking the other way. You know, there's some convenient character flips and devices that are introduced to explain things away and everything. But this had been roughly the Avengers squad when I had stopped reading, was the Black Knight led. I mean, you know, and Cersei was on it. I mean, I think Gilgamesh might have been on it still. I think of this as like the Black Knight, Cersei Avengers of that era. And it was maybe before... I know this is Steve's Thor, but for me, I'm more into the original Thor. This is when he was the personality of the regular dude, so he would be a doofus Thor.
You're so provocative. He can make mistakes. Andrew's being so provocative tonight. But you know, with the connection with the X-Men, like Gary, remember that Harris, Bob Harris, who was writing Avengers.
Right.
Had been the group editor of the X-Men line and was making it very successful. I mean, it was already successful, but he was certainly guiding it through the success of the early 90s here. So I thought at the time, picking these books up off the shelf, that exploring some of this X-Men Avengers connections, and they did it a couple of times with a couple of different storylines, this being one of them, I thought it was kind of fun.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the shared universe and a key, because you have the Starjammers coming over from the X-Men and being in the Avengers, and you have two teams going against each other. You can see in that cover how it's the two teams fighting against each other. You don't even really have a supervillain here.
Like, nobody ever else hung out with the Starjammers except for the X-Men. So it was kind of like spreading some of the gems. Like, you don't have to call and get the X-Office to agree to release the characters to the Avengers issue, because you're the writer and you're the editor of the other books. So I thought it made... We saw some things in the Avengers books that we hadn't seen before in the first 350 issues. So I thought that was... charming at the time.
I know that I faded out of this group of the Avengers just for aesthetic reasons completely. I'm just the surface level dull-witted comic book fan. Like, you took away all the color palette of the Avengers.
Yeah.
You gave them these dull jackets. And you took away Hercules' beard and got him running around in just the green briefs. And I'm thinking, come on, we could. And you blanched Vision completely to make him look like an egg, just like egg palette. And I'm thinking, this is just not pretty anymore.
It's
I don't want to look at this.
It's
I don't want to look
worse.
At it.
But much to Kevin's delight, I was thinking there's a full cutaway schematic by Elliot R. Brown, of course, of the new Avengers mansion in the back.
Of course, and there's that backup story where Jarvis just freaks out.
Well, yeah, he's been having to deal with, and it's been one of the sources of comic relief throughout this run, is because Crystal's there, she's got her toddler, Luna, and their nanny, who is an Inhuman, and this woman in the kitchen, in Jarvis's kitchen, you know what I mean? And it's like, she's not easy to work around. And
no, she's got a...
He's doing his best. You know, he's a repressed Protestant Englishman, and he's just trying to keep it all cool, but this woman, oh!
was her nanny the the cow woman from
oh, Bova?
Bova. From Wondegore Mountain.
Yeah, no one ever questioned her. She was a classy cow. Now, don't be messing with Bova.
She was for Scarlet Witch and those little spirit babies.
Right, right. With the High Evolutionary and all that. Mm-hmm. 4 years later, in the beginning of 1996... Daredevil reaches issue 350, written by Ivan Valiz Jr. and J.M. DeMatteis, with art by Ron Wagner and Bill Reinhold. Paradiso, this one's called. And I gotta say, despite having two writers, the transition is really pretty seamless between the two. And the art team, the art is really nice, but I gotta say, that's pretty much all I can say positive about this issue.
Yeah. I was gonna ask you, Steve, I know what is happening, but it seems like this title, after Chichester leaves, they just keep on handing it off to another writer, and they don't really know what to do for a while, and this is another one of those issues.
They all do their love letters to Miller, and it just becomes the same thing over and over again. In this, the issues leading up to this 350, we've seen Matt Murdock's psyche split up. It's like, who is the yellow Daredevil and all that? And this anniversary issue is Matt's fever dream, or is it, where his blind, dead sensei teacher Stick, back from the Miller run, comes back to teach him some more. And he has to face off against all his other selves. And so he's fighting them, and he's fighting them, and he's running from them. And then he realizes, oh, I just have to accept them and put my hands out and embrace them. And they all come together, and then he's whole. And then he goes home to Karen, lovely Karen. You know, what could go wrong with a nice girl like that?
And she's not evidencing any of the problems that she had before or after this issue.
There were just some.
She gets a nice job at a radio station after this, and it's pretty good for a while.
There were some weird choices as well in the issue. For instance, okay, so it's we're at that transition time when they're basically ditching editor's notes, but right in the beginning they have one, like he's talking about fighting ghosts of the past, and the editor note is, see our recent issues, it's too complicated to explain. But then when it gets to the point where apparently Daredevil kills a sex worker, we get no editor's note. Like, I'm like, that's kind of an issue I think I'd want to see. That seems pretty important, like, to just blow that. See our recent issues, but that time he killed the sex worker, you don't need to read that. We're just gonna blow right through that.
Well, isn't that the out of continuity Man Without Fear?
Yes.
Story?
Yes.
But now it's in continuity, evidently.
Well, that's why it's confusing.
Yeah. I mean,
I never heard of it. I was wondering if it was made up for this issue.
The big thing about it is that this issue signifies the end of the gray armored suit era and the return of the red.
But I feel like we've seen some of these 350 issues where they're trying to bring people in. And I felt this had none of that bringing people in at all. There was one, the concept of collateral damage is certainly interesting. I mean, there's been about 1,000 Punisher comics that cover it. And it's an important point about, like, what is a, but they just kind of address it. And then he's like, well, you know, what are you going to do? It's like, you can't just raise this thing and then let it go and expect me to take you serious. Like, if you want to have some serious psychological thing, fine, but actually grapple with it rather than be like, well, what you gonna do? You know, people gonna die if I get out there and swing. And then I also think aesthetically, like, look, I know we're no longer comics for kids, but him in a black t-shirt and pants is not what I want to see in my superhero comic for 47 pages. You know, like, put him in the colored underwear. Like, that's why we're here. If I want some guy beating some other dude up, I got 150 better movies and TV shows and all that other stuff. Like, we're here for the fancy pajamas. And to not have that, I felt, was weird for all the issue, you know, except for those times when he's fighting his own self. And what's weird is, like, his juvenile self is the most, and I'm like, really, you couldn't beat yourself up from a fort? You've been through how many years of martial arts training, and yet the 14-year-old version of you is the one creating all the problems?
Oh, but that's like, when he was hungry. That's when he was hungry, Andrew.
I think I'll take the guy that's had the years of extensive training with the best fighters in the world over the kid that's hungry if I'm picking people in a fight. But, yeah. So I like I would have liked to just wrestle, pick one of these things, like dealing with your former self or collateral damage, or pick one of them, wrestle with it, put them in pajamas, give us a thrill.
Really a waste of a good art team, because I do think this was a good art team.
Oh, yeah. I thought the art, I was pleased with, like, a lot of, like, flop sweat and crazy eyes and stuff that makes fun artwork.
Also in 1996, Iron Man would not make it to issue 350. Oh, it would
poor Iron Man.
End with issue 332 after the whole The Crossing and Teen Tony, the debacle. It was like, Onslaught, save us from all that, please. And the series would restart its renumbering with issue 500, so it skipped this issue 350 milestone entirely. But if they did have an issue 350, I bet it would have had Dr. Doom in it.
Tell me if they accounted for the issues between that last one and 500 with any other series.
Yeah, I think they did.
Okay.
So there should be an issue that would be the 350th one, yeah, right? You know what I mean?
Any idea at all? Probably they throw me off so hard.
Probably that Tony Stark, director of S.H.I.E.L.D. time, you know, in that series, before the Fraction run where they did the renumbering with the 500. Somewhere in that stuff.
Well, he did have an anniversary issue in Camelot with Dr. Doom.
Yeah, that was 150 and 250, though. That's why I said if 350, it would have to be Doom again, right?
So, like, 350 was maybe War Machine,
huh?
If they did their volume 3, number 26 or something like that, with a legacy number of 350, something to that effect. But I don't know if they didn't make that clear, I guess.
So no.
That's our, a shame. Shame our, on them, shame.
Eighth and last real issue 350 is Uncanny X-Men 350 at the end of 1997, at this time written by Steven Siegel, with art by Joe Mataria and Tim Townsend. This has the big gatefold cover with Gambit in the middle, and he's flanked by the X-Men on one side and the Marauders on the other.
Yeah, this is worth
for
a
reasons.
Few
so, oh, man.
Like, wait, it is, Kevin?
Yeah. Well, the big Gambit secret issue with the foil, people search for this one.
Really?
Oh.
Yeah, this is also the starting of another good X-Men run, so I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but probably the other things.
Well, my suggestion is if you can, the one advantage, like on these scanned ones, the Unlimited cuts out the first two pages where it has the roster and, like, the story up till now section. And I get why they did that, because they're reprinting them in sequence and you can just read the ones before. But I found it was kind of nice. I read it first on Unlimited, and then I went back and busted out those CD-ROMs they did 15 years ago where they sold the entire runs of their titles foolishly. but it was nice to be able to read, like, now I have the official blurb on who Maggot is rather than remembering. But it's nice more to get the setup. I'm not a big Maggot guy personally.
Yeah.
I mean, I know everyone's favorite. I did love that there's like 1,000 characters. That's in an X-Men book. What's key is more characters than I know is if you want to, it should have like 1,000 and you don't know who they are or what they're doing and all sorts of subplots you can't possibly follow. Like, that's X-Men for me.
Yeah, the X-Men.
That's the kind of stuff that kind of got people frustrated with the X-Men title.
Sure.
So many characters coming in and out and so many subplots dipping in and dipping out. And then you're like, well, what happened? Well, wait,
Right, because the X-Men
the 90s, so they don't even, like, they just drop subplots and they don't even do anything.
But it was long before the 90s.
Didn't age well. Like, Maggot, even Spat and Gravel show up, and I'm like, no one's going to know who these are anymore.
It was long before the 90s, those guys, because, like, Gary and Andrew and Alan and I, being older readers, remember that ever since the Claremont days, the X-Men has been infamous for leaving plot lines dangling, sometimes for years, sometimes never being revisited because of Claremont's MO of setting up plot lines so far in advance from deciding which one he was going to develop that some of them just got lost in the shuffle. And after Claremont was removed from writing the X-Men, it became a bit of a sport in the 90s for the other writers to try to tie up some of that unfinished business. And one such plot line was Bishop learning about the existence of an ex-traitor that was revealed all but the traitor's identity through a dramatic 911 type transmission from Jean Grey in Uncanny X-Men 287. That was Jim Lee and Scott Lobdell time. And this all happens in the future because Bishop's a time traveler, and he visits the Witness, who is an elderly, crackling with energy Gambit. And Bishop asks him who the Witness or who the traitor was, but Gambit doesn't actually reveal the identity. So 5 years later, in the first Onslaught X-Men, which was written by Mark Waid and Scott Lobdell, that transmission from Jean Grey gets played out, and we see it happening with her recognizing Professor X as Onslaught, as the traitor to the X-Men. So then in this issue, another few years later, some X-Men infiltrate Magneto's old abandoned Arctic base, where Gambit is being held captive, and they're ambushed by Eric the Red, which totally blew my mind. I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. How can this possibly be? And they awaken to a trial, and Gambit is the defendant, and Eric the Red is the prosecutor, Angel is the defender, and the robotic Ferris is presiding. Really weird.
I know Joe Mad is well acclaimed, but this was an era I wasn't reading. So it's pretty intense to jump in another one where, like, the extreme stylistic choices are somewhat jarring, especially when the characters are out of outfits. Luckily, I think the writer makes a lot of effort to sort of identify them, because it can be hard for me to place who these characters are at times when they're doing it. There's a lot going on in this issue for someone picking up an issue.
And then I came back and then I saw that Magneto was going by the Joseph name for a while, and I thought that was totally strange.
But with Fabio's hair, you know?
Yeah. Plus, they had you could get a Marvel Comics credit card. And I'm like, they filed bankruptcy like a year ago. I don't know that I'm running out buying a credit card with their name. Does that mean my purchases are going to get rejected?
So during this trial, it gets revealed that Gambit not only worked for Mr. Sinister, but he assembled the Marauders and participated in their mutant massacre in the Morlock tunnels.
Heartbreaking.
That doesn't go over well. So did this plot line get solved twice? Because you know what I mean? It was Onslaught was the traitor, but no, Gambit was the traitor. Like, it seems like they, like the Summers brother thing, they came back and solved it two times.
I never
different traitor.
The area of Onslaught, so I always thought Gambit was the traitor.
Yeah.
I think they originally intended for Gambit to be the traitor that Jean Grey was supposed to have identified. But the Onslaught line-wide event, as events tend to do, took precedence, and then they slotted the Onslaught thing in there.
Yep.
And I think they derailed who the traitor was supposed to be, and then they just followed through with their storyline anyway.
In the end, the X-Men escape with Gambit, and in the end, Eric the Red reveals himself to Ferris to be Magneto. So Joseph isn't Magneto. And now I'm like, all right, at least I feel better about the Eric the Red thing. But then I'm thinking, wait a minute, he went through all that effort just to shame Gambit to Rogue, basically, and break them up. I'm like, this is like Mephisto taking all the time and making the effort just to break up somebody's marriage. And but then I remembered Savage Land Rogue. Right? She had a dalliance with Magneto, so this is all sour grapes. He's like, if I can't have her, no one will.
Yeah. Spurned lover.
Gambit.
Well, this also leads into a good Gambit ongoing series later on, too.
I was a little confused because there's panels that have Joseph and Eric the Red together. So I didn't know if the Joseph thing was fake or like a put on. But how could they be in the same or two different bodies?
I think he's
bodies?
A clone.
Clone.
Okay. But at this point, it was hard. Yeah, I would have liked he should be able to put those together. My other problem was Gambit, I never warmed to the character. I thought his goofy kind of fake. And I know we all love when Stan taught us three words of German and Russian with Russian face characters and all that, but they really pour on. Like, I feel sorry for anyone that's from New Orleans reading this. They must think like we're all hillbilly buffoon. Like, they really lean into like he's some hick from the sticks in a way that I would be insulted personally. And so I'm like, I don't know,
buddy. That's not in the sticks. That's Cajun. That's right, sexy right. Cajun talk.
I don't think that's my aunt, my great aunt. Aunt's jambalaya easier going down than up, or what? Like, he talks like somebody's embarrassing uncle. Like, that's
if it was deeper in the wood, it would be moonshine. So jambalaya is evocative of Cajun Louisianan lifestyle. You have to they lean into it, but they're not leaning into a hick kind of lifestyle. They're leaning into a kind of swarthy, cultural, New Orleans kind of generational Cajun life.
I'm just saying, I don't know how much research Steven Seagal did. And I'm willing to bet
now,
this is leading into some fair amount of stereotyping.
Like guys, I know this is Marvel noise, but I'm reading the Azzarello Rizzo book, Moonshine, and it has stuff going on down in New Orleans and in the swamps and stuff. And the dialogue there takes a while to get into the cadences of it too, but it's written so much more masterfully than this dialogue, let me tell you.
I have to admit, I get worn out with the D's and the Do's and the Tats and that gets on my nerves after a while.
And then, not to derail us more, but at the end, there was a two-page spread on this video game, Ashes of the Apocalypse, I wanted to ask Kevin about. Because he's my video game expert.
Where did this come out from?
It's a two-page interview about this excellent first-person computer game using state-of-the-art 3D graphics. And as near as I can tell, it's vaporware. It never came out. I couldn't find it, but I'm like, well, Kevin will know. It's 97 or whatever. He's a big video game guy.
I was out of video games at that time.
But I just loved like this two-page thing, and then I look it up and there's nothing. They're like, well, they had a Doom port in. And I'm like, no, this is a full like, and it just disappeared. It looks great. It's like you fight Apocalypse and you can play all the superheroes and it's 3D rendered. They got a scene with Wolverine and his claws out and Magneto. And I'm like, whoa, where is our missing video game segment that Kevin promised me?
I thought it was interesting overall for these issue 350s as a group. I think they were better than the issue 300s. I think there were quite a few stinkers, average comics amongst the 300s. And here it was like the earlier issues were the good ones. And then as it got to the end of, once we got into the 90s with Avengers, Daredevil, and Uncanny, it seemed like some of the quality dropped off as far as what it takes to make it an anniversary issue here, you know. But these were fun to revisit. There was some good comics here. I think it's amazing that Doom shows up so much, and also that it's been since 97 since we have had an issue 350.
Well, I noticed you guys put up a big fight about Iron Man, but when Millie the Model dropped off our list of anniversaries, none of you guys are like, hey, how can we reconfigure that one to make 350?
Well, what about Conan? Conan's over 350. We'll put all those together.
Bat City. What about What about Hellcat? Every time she shows up in her own title, they should have a legacy number from Patsy.
Patsy Walker. I mean, you're getting down to the core, right? Siding out Iron Man. Like, we're kind of looking at what I would say is the first thoughts of the Marvel Universe. And that's not like we all love Iron Fist and Luke Cage and all that, but I'm just saying, when we think of the core titles, I mean, maybe you could think of like Defenders squeaking up there.
What about Doctor Strange?
Defenders barely made it to 150. But yeah, Doctor Strange, other like series, yeah. Well, that's why we'll never see it again, right? Because of how they restart the series. But that really only started, what, a decade ago or so? And we're talking, it's been 25 years since we've had a issue 350. It's just notable, that's all. Not a complaint.
Yeah, well, they were with the legacy numbering for a while, and then they just dropped that. They buried it for a year and a half.
Yeah, yeah.
I hope some intern is still keeping track, though. I hope somebody still got it.
Legacy numbering going on right now.
Someone's got to know what issue Moon Knight is on, right?
Yeah.
Or the Black Panther. These guys who have these series that pop up and disappear and pop up and disappear.
They better.
All right, that's our episode 350 extravaganza. Thank you, everyone, for coming on. Alan, where, again, can we find the Power Principle?
You can find the Power Principle at the Power Principle, P-L-E at the end of principle, .co. Leave off the M for mutant. There's issues 1 to 12 on there. I have finished issue 13. It is completely done.
Nice.
And I'm starting... Great. I'm starting the director's cut of issue 1 and 2, and I don't know how far I'm going to go with that, but I've just reached a different level of skill, and I want to put it back to the original story and go on from there. So that's my director's cut.
That's
but
fun.
I don't know how I'm going to distribute that yet.
That'll be cool. We'll be here when you do. And Gary, thank you. You're always welcome to come on the show.
Thank you.
Andrew and Kevin, thanks for being here for most of the last 250 episodes or so.
That's crazy. But you wouldn't let me on the main show for a while.
Up ahead on future episodes, we'll continue to explore classic Nova Tales, plus the New Warriors, and maybe some more Doom 2099. And, of course, Tomb of Dracula with Jerry McDade when Halloween comes around. So, until Team America gets an issue 350, make mine Marvel.
Later. I'm holding out for NFL Super Pro, Steve.
Everybody's looking for somebody's arms to fall into. It's what it is now. Yeah, forest on the graves and monuments, taverns of warm town. People curse their government and shovel hard food down. Lights are out in City Hall, the castle and the keep. The moon shines down upon it all, the legless and the sleeping. Cold on Toby. With the wagons creeping through, cold on the toll gate, God knows what to do with you. It's what it is. It's what it is now. Oh yeah, the garrison sleeps in the citadel with a ghost in the ancient stone. High on the parapet, a Scottish piper stands alone. And high on the wind, a Highland drum's begin to roll. Something from the past just comes and stares into my soul. It's cold on the toll gate with a Caledonian blue. Cold on the toll gate, God knows what I could do with you. It's what it is. It's what it is now. It's what it is. tinkle light, there's a burning wick, there's a landing in the tower. We will even give you the candlesticks, still writing songs in the radios on Charlotte Street. Take a walk and stick from my tail. The ghost of Dirty Dick is still in search of a little man.